and welcome to the Wine Access Unfiltered podcast. It is season three, and I am so thrilled to be back because we've got a brand new chapter of episodes for you guys that I think you're going to love. We started thinking about this season back in season two and brainstormed a lot about what we should do in season three. Season one, as you guys will remember, was all about guests who joined us from all different backgrounds, different industries. So we had musicians, we had comedians, we had supermodels, and they all shared their stories around wine, what got them excited, what made them nervous. And we really got to know people through their own lens of wine and kind of offered a little bit of perspective. In season two, we introduced the wine club and we centered each episode around a theme or a topic in the wine world that was sort of ranging from regions like Champagne and Portugal to winemaking styles like whole cluster and malolactic fermentation, and even how to decipher vintages and build a proper wine collection no matter your budget. And so when we looked at everything that we had covered, all 60 plus episodes, we thought, I think this might be time to take this information and send everyone out into the wild with it. Let's put it into practice. And so season three is going to do just that. We're going to teach you how to be a savvy wine buyer. So buying tips, red flags, green flags, all the inside baseball on how wines get chosen for importing and putting in a store. We're going to build upon everything that we've covered so far and take you to that next level of your wine journey, because this is yours. We're just helping you along the way. And I have to tell you, I don't think this is going to be an easy feat for me. I think I have a big challenge ahead, but I also don't plan on doing it alone. And to that end, when I started racking my brain on how to do this, there was one person that came to mind. She is the only American to have won nearly every major wine award given. That does include the highly coveted and very difficult to earn as a wine person, the James Beard Award. She's been profiled in Time Magazine, hosted her own TV show. She was the former wine correspondent on the Today Show, and is the creator and chair emeritus of the Rudd Center for Professional Wine Studies at the Culinary Institute of America in Napa Valley. I honestly could go on, but perhaps the thing that most of you will know her from is as the author of the best-selling wine book in the United States, now in its third edition, The Wine Bible. I'm honored to call her a friend and a colleague. Please welcome to the show, Karen McNeil.
Hi, Amanda.
Hello. It's so, so, so good to have you here. In our third season, I can't believe it's taken us so long, but I can't think of a better person to kick this off with, because if anyone knows how to be a savvy wine buyer, it's you. I mean, you've got one thing that I didn't mention was wine speed. Your entire newsletter is sort of centered around this topic of being a savvy wine buyer.
Yes, it is. And so I'm really looking forward to talking about this, because I think there really are some wonderful practical tips to set people off in the right direction.
I think so too. And that is one of my questions for you. Like, is this a lifelong journey that takes years and years of practice? Or do you think there are ways to sort of shortcut it?
You know, I think the challenge for any of us when we buy wine is one, overcoming overwhelm, right? Whether you're looking online at, you know, wine.com or any other digital store, or you're standing there in the store looking up at 700 labels, it can be paralyzing in a sense. It's just the world of wine. The good part of it is there are a lot of choices. The bad part of it is there are a lot of choices.
The other thing that I think people maybe don't know about you is, one, you're very funny and witty, but two, you know, I think before I got to know you, you're so poised and you're so put together, and there's always just this grace and elegance about you that I saw from afar. But one of my favorite and first memories of you, and you might remember this, is we were at a tasting together and you were sitting right next to me. I won't say what the tasting was or where we were, but there was a moment in the tasting where it seemed like what they were saying in the tasting and what we were drinking were, we'll just call it, misaligned. And we all just kind of sat there like whispering to each other. Nobody was really saying anything. And all of a sudden you raised your hand in the most like calm, confident way. And you asked the question. And I don't remember what the question was, but you did it in a way that just commanded the room's attention. And we all just went, oh my God, she said what we were all thinking. And the room went silent. No one said anything. And you just sat there as if like just cool as a cucumber. And I never forgot. And I remember like my friend was sitting next to me and I grabbed her leg and I was like, oh my God, did she just say that? And I saw you after and we talked about it. And I thought to myself, my God, I want to be Karen McNeil when I grow up. She has nerves of steel. How does she do that?
You know, I think in a way, being a journalist is like the best cover, you know, that you could possibly have, right? Because it gives you license to ask almost any question. I mean, obviously it can't be in bad taste or personal or right. something, you know, manipulative or badly intentioned. But other than that, you really can ask what everybody's thinking. And you almost, as a journalist, you almost have an obligation to do that, right? Because otherwise wine remains this esoteric idea up on the shelf. Nobody really challenges any of the 10 wine commandments, you know, that came down with Moses. But no, it's part of being a good journalist.
It's all about intention in life, right? If you have good intentions and you're asking a question to genuinely get an answer, it's okay to ask a question. And I think in the wine world, there's so much fear around asking the wrong questions or looking stupid.
I often wondered myself, why is that about wine, right? Because I don't know, if it was a car, you wouldn't be afraid to say, listen, I don't know what horsepower is, right? I mean, explain that to me.
Right.
Our life is full of things that we're not experts in, that we're not reluctant to ask questions about. But for some reason, wine becomes this, you know, very intimidating topic, which we feel we should know, when of course it's insane. We're not supposed to know all of this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way one could know it all. And by the way, of course, it's the world of wine. So we're supposed to know what? Everything about French wine, Italian wine, German wine, Chinese wine, New Zealand wine, Hungarian wine.
Right.
I mean, the only sane response really is to ask a lot of questions.
As we segue into our next, we're going to talk about cultural events in just a second, because you continue asking the questions on your Instagram. So let's talk about what's going on in the world of wine. We're going to start with our friend George Clooney. Are you a George Clooney fan, Karen?
Is any living, breathing woman in America not? Of course I am.
Fair, fair.
Regrettably, he's married, but okay. All right. I still. Yeah.
And so we can all aspire to live the life of Amal Clooney, of course. George Clooney is moving from the film world to the spirits world and now into the wine world, following suit his friend Brad Pitt. He purchased an estate in Provence with Amal. It's a 420-acre estate that was purchased in 2021. And Wine Spectator is reporting that he will start soon producing wine under Domaine du Canadel. And the agronomist Lawrence Berlemont, who also worked on Miraval, is going to be a part of the project. I don't know. Are you a celebrity wine fan? Are you skeptical? What's your take on George?
I mean, far be it from George and Amal Clooney to buy something like 10 acres. No, 420 acres
right.
on the Riviera. Of course, it just is so romantic. It's hard to get over. But I love Provence Rosé, and that's probably what they're making, right? I mean, that will be primarily mm-hmm. what they'll make. And would I want to taste their wine? You bet I want to taste their wine.
Yes.
I don't think being a celebrity automatically makes you a good winemaker, but I do believe that they have the money to do it really right. And if you couple that with a sort of passion to do it right, and I'm assuming he's got that too, then there's no reason that that wine won't be really delicious.
I am in the same camp. I think he's clearly succeeded at lots of different ventures. He started as an actor. He was a TV actor, turned film actor, turned director, turned entrepreneur with his own, Tequila? Casamigos Tequila. Sold that. And now he's getting into, and I, you know, they reported that he's got the Midas touch. And I I think he probably does. I think he knows how to align himself with the right people. And with that combination of resources, I say, why not? I don't think every celebrity wine out there or even product out there is a good idea, but I would be excited to try his wine. And, you know, it's also not very expensive to make good Provence rosé. So,
in fact, he's only done one thing wrong that I can see, and that is that he hasn't hired you and me as consultants yet. But we're going to give him time on this. He might come to his senses. He might need two smart Napa Valley women to, you know, just make sure that this is truly a great venture.
George, Amal, call us. We're available for a trip to Provence. We'll do it in Napa Valley if you want to come to us. We'll even fly to LA. The possibilities are endless. We know rosé. If you wanted to do a red and a white, we can help with that as well. So we're here for you if you need us. Moving on, Karen McNeil. I text so many people when I saw this post go up on Instagram. It was a good one. It was straight after PNV, and I will read you the caption. For those of you who are not following Karen, by the way, on Instagram, you should absolutely be following her. I think it's Karen McNeil Co. We'll link everything below. The caption reads as follows. All of these wineries employ the consultant Philippe Melka. All of these wineries make plush, soft, well-structured, very expensive Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. Is it a problem if many of them taste largely the same? Let us know your thoughts in the comments below. And did they ever leave us their comments and thoughts below? Because this was a photo that you posted from a tasting that happens every year. It's the Atelier Melka tasting. It happens during PNV week, a very big week for Napa Valley that brings out people from all over the world, really for this auction that culminates at the end of the week on Saturday. But, you know, these tastings sort of happen. And once again, you said what everyone was thinking. And you asked the question.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, of course, I like Philippe. We both know him. He's a nice guy. He's a talented person. But here, you know, here's my point. We all know, you hear, if you're an avid wine drinker and or if you're in the biz, you hear all the time that wine is supposed to be reflective of its place, right? It's the age-old idea of terroir, that what makes wine so moving emotionally is that it's the voice of a piece of land. Okay, I hear that all the time. I get, you know, notes from PR people all the time that say that. You do too. But you can't have it that way and then hire a consultant who makes one style of wine and 30 wineries in the same room essentially making wine that tastes pretty similar. Mm-hmm. So which is it? And I don't have a horse in this race. I'm not a winemaker, but I just think it's internally inconsistent on the one hand to say, oh yes, we're trying to make, you know, a wine that is reflective of just this beautiful property on Howell Mountain with the trees around it and rah, 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 rah. And by the way, it tastes almost identical to 40 other wineries here.
You know, Philippe, outside of, well, I guess it's now under Atelier Melka. And to your point, Philippe is a lovely human being. He couldn't be nicer. Mayan, the same. I have nothing but lovely things to say about them. But I think the question has to be raised because outside of some of those projects, you know, you do see, like, I think in the early days of his winemaking, you did see, like, with CV, when he was making CV, with Lael, which he still makes, you did see, you know, very terroir-specific wines. And the question that I have is, you know, as he's moved into this consultant era, you know, he's built this huge business for himself called Atelier Melka, in which people hire him and his team to make their wines. Who's at fault here? Because I think there is something to be said for the vanity vintner, the person that comes in and either buys the land or more likely wants to start a label as a project because they made their money in some other way and they want to basically come in and, you know, live the Napa Valley dream. And so they do the checklist, right? They hire Howard Backen to design their winery. They hire David Abreu to farm the land. They hire Philippe Melka to make the wine, or Thomas Rivers Brown, or whomever, right? Because there's a few different examples of this across the valley. And there has been so much of that over the last 20, 30 years of people chasing this dream, this 100-point dream, because if anyone can deliver on it, it's Philippe Melka. And so I have to wonder, like, who's really at fault here? Is it Philippe or is it the people that are coming in that are interested in the Napa Valley fame and fortune that don't care about showcasing terroir? All they care about is getting a 100-point score from X, Y, and Z.
I think that's right. For a project that sort of talks the talk of terroir but doesn't walk the walk, really what those projects are in a sense, ego manifestations. Mm-hmm. And then they want an insurance policy. And hiring a certain consultant is, to some extent, an insurance policy that critics will pay attention to. So I would add that if we're going to share some blame here, maybe critics should be involved in there too. But, you know, one of the sad aspects about this for me, and the consulting winemaker, this phenomenon that you just described, is it's not solely a Napa Valley phenomenon, but it was raised to a high art in the Napa Valley.
Yes.
What is so sad is that, and people don't realize that under Philippe, there are 30 winemakers, right? Not who work for his atelier studio Melka, but who actually work for those wineries. And they're the people dragging the hoses around, filling the barrels, topping up, taking care of the wine on a day-by-day basis. And they live and breathe that piece of ground. When you have a consulting winemaker who whizzes in once a month or once every 2 months and thinks about a few things and maybe helps with the blend, that person, so much of the fame and attention is directed to that person that the man or the woman who's doing the daily work, who may be in fact a brilliant winemaker, no one ever gets to meet those people. No one ever gets to know those people. And those people might have made a very different decision. Those people might have made a wine more reflective of their place.
I couldn't agree more. The top billing for the consulting winemaker over the person that's actually making the wine is a problem. And it's not a problem from this person should get credit. It's a problem because, to your point, what are we missing in the process by not allowing the people who are living and breathing these parts and this wine to make the decisions? And I'm not there in the process. I don't know how involved Philippe is. I don't know who's getting final say and how, you know, how much input is being taken into consideration. But you do see it all the time. And it's one of the things that we loved about Napa Valley sort of coming up in the early days of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You had some of the godfathers, right? You had Andrei Chelyuchev, you had Mondavi, you had all these guys that were, you know, kind of peppering in their input here and there, but they never got top billing. You know, nobody was ever saying Andrei Chelyuchev is making this wine or consulting on this wine. It was Kathy Corison or Philippe Tongi or, you know, and Randy Dunn, like these people who ended up having incredible careers themselves without any sort of top billing from a consulting winemaker. And so I wonder how long this can persist, because you are seeing at a very, very high level, people start to not use consulting winemakers. Like, for example, Brian Estate doesn't use a consulting winemaker. Screamy Eagle has had Nick as the head winemaker and does not use a consulting winemaker. Even Harlan, you know, really only uses their Corey for...
And Bob Levy
and David Chile from Promontory. You know, these guys are the winemakers and they're not utilizing. And so it's interesting to me that, you know, sort of at one tier, you're seeing no consulting winemaker. And then you have this huge, huge chunk of Napa Valley using consulting and then kind of everyone else using their own. So I wonder if that delta is ever going to close and we'll see. But, you know, I think this Instagram post, if anything, sort of added a layer of color that we all needed to see. And hopefully gave agency to those who maybe saw the post that are utilizing that to, you know, start maybe reconsidering their options. And speaking of reconsidering their options, one other thing that you decided to do in 2024 was kind of force the hand of those who were using the big monster bottles, you know, those big, we've all seen them, we've all received them in the mail, huge, heavy monster bottles. As of January 15th, you have decided to no longer write or critique wines packaged in heavy, thick glass. How, why did we arrive at this decision? Because I love it.
I'm having such a good time getting myself into trouble.
I can see that.
And everyone does know what we're talking about here. These are like the wine equivalent of Hummers, right? They're in giant bottles. When they're empty, they feel like they're full. When they are full, they weigh about 5 pounds or 4.8 pounds. And a regular old normal bottle weighs about 3 to 3.5 pounds when it's full. So, you know, I was sitting here in my office. We taste about, I don't know, 2,500 wines a year. And we were tasting some Cabernets, and there were a few of these giant bottles. And I had read earlier this year that as much as 40% of a winery's carbon footprint comes from glass bottles and from shipping glass bottles. And all of a sudden, just the insanity of this hit me that, again, how can a winery whose whole emotional basis should be thinking about protecting the land and protecting nature and caring for the land and using regenerative or organic and or biodynamic sustainable practices in order to leave the land in good shape. When you talk that talk, okay, I get it. But then don't put the wine, damn it, in a giant bottle that has a massive carbon footprint. If you're going to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. And, you know, I think we both remember even 10 years ago when these giant bottles, you know, you were impressed by them. You thought, wow. I mean, and a lot of wineries believe that people are still impressed. And I, you know, I came out and said, we're not impressed anymore. In fact, this is insulting. If you really care about nature, about terroir, about the environment, about your piece of land, stop doing this. And so the only, you know, I don't have that much power, but the power that I do have was to decide to not write about wines like that anymore, even when the wine is good. And when wineries say to me, oh, but you know, the wine is good. I'm like, you know what? Take all the money that you put into that glass and put it in your vineyard or put it in or give it to the winemaker. Do something better with the money that you would have used to produce these giant, almost sometimes now grotesque bottles.
Right.
I just think nobody's impressed by them anymore. There was a time, but that was before climate chaos was all around us. And now we have to rethink that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there was a time when it was impressive and it was a signal, right? It was an easy way for someone to say, wow, this is a wine that's worth money. There's value here. And I think in some ways it also offered a little value add. You know, it was that extra little bump of incentive to purchase because they said, oh, it comes in a heavy bottle. You know, maybe I'll use it as a dumbbell. Who knows? I don't know why we like them. But to your point, we have come a long way. And when those started becoming popularized in the early mid 2000s, you know, it was at a time when that was kind of, you know, the ethos of the world, right? Bigger was better. There was, you know, people were spending lots of money. There was a lot of money in the economy. And, you know, we fell out of that. And the wine really hasn't followed suit. And I think we've also been too scared to go backwards, right? I think people really, as you know, the wine world moves very slowly and is reluctant to go, you know, forwards, even if it means going backwards. So it's interesting to me how many people are still using these bottles, knowing what we know about how detrimental it is to the environment, knowing that we're completely reliant on the environment. You know, it seems so ass backwards. It baffles me when I see it. And the other question I had for you was, in the same vein of bottles, we also see a lot of wineries packaging in wooden wine crates and, you know, the wooden wine boxes being, and, you know, I just mentioned a few wineries that still send their three packs in the wooden wine box, which I would argue is potentially just as bad because they're still very heavy and, you know, wood is maybe better in some ways, but like not really. So are you going to take a similar stance?
We're so sad when we see those wooden crates because, like you, you know, they end up just out in the garbage, right? In the they are recyclable. At least wood is recyclable. Styrofoam is a giant problem in the wine industry right now because most shippers, those foam styrofoam molds that wine is often shipped in, those styrofoam is just terrible for the environment. I mean, as strong as I feel about this, I'm also sympathetic for wineries in the sense that there hasn't been a lot of packaging innovation yet. That's starting really fast right now, though. I think in the next 5 years, we'll stop seeing styrofoam and we'll stop seeing wines being shipped in wooden boxes. And we'll even start seeing different and lighter weight bottles. In fact, lighter weight bottles, here's the funny thing. Well, it's not so funny, but lighter weight bottles, which are now available, cost a winery more to buy. Mm. The shipping costs less, but you have to really manufacture those bottles really well because they're, you know, they're in a sense slightly less physically stable. Nonetheless, the price of lighter weight bottles will come down. I have had wineries write me who make, you know, who still put their wine in these giant heavy bottles saying, you know, will you please still taste the wine? We get it. We're going to stop using these heavy bottles, but it's going to take us a year to 2 years to do this because we all bottled our Cabernet in these giant bottles. And if that's the case, then I will taste the wine because I have their word, right? Their word that in fact, they are going to stop using these heavy bottles. So it takes, I mean, the wine industry, it's hard to move fast. It takes a while. But it starts with consciousness, right? It starts with people being aware of a better way. And then people do want to sell their wine. They will follow through if you're aware that you'd like it to happen in a better way, in a sounder way, in a more environmentally friendly way.
Consciousness and a conversation. And I think those two things are what you are bringing to the table. And we can't thank you enough for that. The conversation will continue in just a second, but I have to remind everyone that the Wine Club is still very much going through to season three. So if you are not a member of the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club, the longest name for a wine club in wine club history, now is your time to jump on it. Four bottles every 8 weeks, I pick them. They are things that I like to drink here at home. And then we also, of course, tie them into the episode as we will when we come back. So if you've got that wine club shipping on you today, we are drinking this lovely Chenon that is in your box. I will be drinking that with Karen when we come back. All right. Well, first and foremost, cheers to you.
Thank you. Cheers back.
And making the wine world a much better place. Because if not for voices like, and I mean this, if not for voices like you, the wine world would stay the same. We would all continue just humdrumming away, making the grape juice, selling it the way we were. But it takes charismatic leaders. It takes conviction and a whole lot of savviness to do what you do and move the needle, even if it's, you know, just a gentle, small direction in the right way. So for that, I am always, always appreciative. We have a beautiful Chenon, as I mentioned. This is the Pascal A. Alain Florio Expression Chenon. So what does all that mean? So that there that I just said, that is the producer. So Pascal A. Alain Florio, that's the producer. The Expression is the cuvée of this particular wine. And Chenon is the place that it's coming from. Chenon is in the Loire Valley. We actually did a fantastic episode covering the entire Loire Valley with our friends John and Reed Scupney, who I'm sure Karen knows from Lang and Reed. And we are talking about the grape Cabernet Franc in this glass. When we're talking about Chenon, we're largely only talking about Cabernet Franc. So on this, you should be getting lots of fruit, a little bit of like herbaceousness, a little bit of rosiness. And I will tell you, I may have opened this last night and it is continuing to get better because I wanted a glass last night. But what I also love is that you're also getting, you know, kind of this earthy umami blanket on here as well, which for me is like sort of Cabernet Franc in a nutshell. But hopefully you're enjoying this. This is all done in stainless steel. So it's really fresh. It's really lively. It's not, you know, a super big Cabernet Franc like you might expect from Napa or from the Right Bank of Bordeaux. It's fun. It's fresh. It's kind of, you know, it's meant for picnicking as one does in the Loire Valley, I presume.
And people may not realize that Cabernet Franc is Cabernet Sauvignon's father. Cabernet Sauvignon and Sauvignon Blanc had this very nice moment in nature about 500 years ago. And the result was Cabernet Sauvignon. And Cabernet Franc is so, I think it's a little bit undervalued, but at the same time I say that, it is right now the most expensive grape in the Napa Valley to buy.
Yep.
People think that that would be Cabernet Sauvignon, but it's actually Cabernet Franc because Cabernet Franc is, you know, it's like Pinot Noir. It's very pesky. It doesn't like to be planted just anywhere. Everything has to be just right for it. But I agree, this Chenin is beautiful. It's so alive and violety, and it's intensely flavored, but it's not at all heavy or ponderous. Mm-hmm. It's like twirling around here with lots of energy.
Yeah, I always tell people if they like the essence of Cabernet Sauvignon but are not in for the heaviness and the intensity and that, you know, those grippy Cabernet Franc is like your jam all day long. You know, it's fresh, it's fun, it's usually very floral, but it still has all the things that we sort of love about Cabernet Sauvignon. And as I mentioned, this is all done in stainless steel, which should be sort of a signal when you see that a red wine especially is done in stainless steel. That usually means that the wine is intended for earlier consumption. Usually, not always, but usually. The winemaker wants that wine to stay fresh. They want it to stay vibrant. And they want you to likely enjoy it with the chill. Usually when you see wines that are not done in oak, it means that they actually, you know, don't want to be consumed at that 55 to 60 degrees, they actually like it a little bit cooler, which I think is really the name of the game here. You're going to love it. You know, take it out of the fridge about 15 minutes before you're going to drink it. Don't drink it super, super cold. I have mine in my Gabriel glass here, which is just a universal wine glass, but I think this is something you can enjoy out of a Burgundy glass. I can't see your glass. Is it your glass? Because you have a line of glassware, right?
Yes.
Yes.
May as well do something else as well.
Why not?
But you know, the other thing to your point, Amanda, about in stainless steel, the wine is made in stainless steel. To me, what that also signals is whatever flavors are there, whatever fruit flavors, whatever outdoorsy flavors, you're going to get a really pure expression of that because there's nothing to cover up the purity of that. So a wine like Chenin, especially a wine like this, can't hide behind, you know, it's like if you didn't have really good vegetables, you could always throw some cream sauce on them and no one would know, right? So oak is the big cream sauce. If you don't have really great grapes, put a few oak chips in there and maybe people will be fooled by the disguise. But if you make a wine in stainless steel, really, the grapes have to be, their purity, it's transparent. It's going to show. So you have to have really good grapes to have the courage, in a sense, to do that.
I asked this question earlier, is becoming a savvy wine buyer just a time thing or does it require years of studying and patience? And you said you have a little tip in this regard. So what are your thoughts?
When I think about being a buyer, buying wine, and that overwhelm issue, I'm reminded about something that I did when I was a young woman learning about wine. I just sort of happened upon this idea. Instead of, you know, staring up at that big wall or that screen with 10,000 wines and wondering what to do, choose any country. It doesn't matter what country, New Zealand, Spain, any country. But for the next 2 months, only drink wine from that country. It doesn't matter what you're eating or anything else. Only you're just going to drink Spanish wine for, let's say, 2 months. If you do that, and if you drink wine several times a week, at the end of 2 months, you're going to realize, oh, you kind of have a feel for the flavors of Spanish wine. It's not that you're an expert yet, maybe, but yeah, you've got a taste feel for them. And now move to another country. Maybe New Zealand's next. Doesn't matter. And now you're going to spend 2 to 3 months only drinking the wines of New Zealand. Nothing else. Every time. And 2 to 3 months later, you'll be like, I think I get, I have a feel for this now. And so it takes like 2 years to do this, go around the world. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you'll realize, oh my goodness, the world has now fallen into these kind of silos of flavor. And I can see it now.
One of the beauties of wine is that you can shop the world, right? But that's also one of the things that can trip us up the most. And it's almost like trying to learn 15 different languages at once.
Yes.
Right? It's just too much information. It's too conflicting. And, you know, the first piece of information that someone will tell you if you want to learn a language is, right, to move to the country, spend some time in the land where it's spoken and get to know it. And I think the same could be said about wine, right? Really intimately get to know the place, get to know the cuisine, get to know all of the different ways in which they produce wine and the varieties that they use. And then how do you narrow it down? Once, you know, if you're in the wine store, let's say you've decided upon Spain, what on the label are you looking for? Are you looking at the front? Are you looking at the back? What are the pieces of information that are signaling, yes, this is good. No, this is probably not what I want.
I think when in the very beginning, I'm actually trying not to figure out too much information. I'm trying to be like a five-year-old looking at the Baskin-Robbins ice cream board, right? Like, pistachio ice cream. What would that be like? You have to have the courage, in a sense, to be experimental. I mean, and if you think about it, when you were 5 years old, you didn't know what pistachio ice cream tasted like, or black raspberry, or coffee ice cream, or anything else. But you didn't care because you were a kid. You're like, okay, let me try it. And if I don't like it, I won't ever order coffee ice cream again, or I'll make my dad buy me another one. So that kind of innocent willingness to try is a good thing. I do think this, though, having just said that, you know, wine is expensive. I think everyone should divide the amount of money they're going to spend into two camps. One is, I'm going to spend I'm going to spend 50% of all the money I might spend online on stuff I know, because I just want to feel confident about it. And I don't want to be experimental tonight. I just want a flavor that I know I'm going to like.
Right.
And then the other 50%, though, is I'm going to be the kid looking up at the ice cream board, and I'm going to be very experimental, because it's only by doing that that you expand your universe of wines that you know. If you continue, the best way to learn nothing about wine is to continue to drink what you already know you like.
I love that. I think being a savvy wine buyer requires an element of trust and experimentation. And the trust is in yourself. The trust is in yourself to say, I like this or I don't like this. And it's okay to not like things, and it's okay to like things that maybe you are surprised by, that maybe somebody else didn't like quite as much. We all have different palates, no different than, I'm sure there's lots of things that I like to eat that you probably don't enjoy. And we can agree to disagree on that front. And I think that's also why so many of us are reticent to say, only follow the critics and the scores. You know, there's always room for interpretation. When I look at bottles and I'm sort of, you know, starting to narrow down, one of the things that I like to do is, especially for really focusing on region, is, to me, if you're between two bottles, right, let's say they're the same price, one of my little hacks in life is I try to go with the one that has the more specific location. You know, So if it's California versus Central Coast, or even better, Central Coast versus Paso Robles, right? Those are two different distinctions that I think can lend themselves to quality. And that isn't universally true, but I do think that the more specific a bottling can be about the location, the likely it is going to be slightly higher quality. Things I don't really pay attention to so much are alcohol. I think that's one thing that people maybe get tripped on. You're nodding your head. I think you're maybe in agreement on that.
I am in agreement. Yeah.
Yeah. It's less of a tell than I think people realize. You know, the average alcohol of a wine is somewhere between 13.5% and 14.5% alcohol. But what many people don't realize is that there's always sort of this
wiggle room
that they can legally live within. So it's not a big a tell as you might think. The other thing that you should be paying attention to, especially if you are doing what Karen says and drinking according to region, is paying attention to the importer who brought it in. And we'll do an episode on this moving forward. But is that something that you have sort of latched onto in your career, is paying attention to that?
So true. Importers have, you know, they're in many ways the great unsung heroes of the wine world. And importers have very specific proclivities. They like certain styles of wine. And so when you find that you really like a wine, notice who the importer is, because there's a good chance you might like this importer's other wines from other places too, because you like their palate in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Tech sheets. I know that we get sent a lot of tech sheets. Is it something, and you can always look these up online, especially when you are, you know, Wine Access always has a great rundown of what the grapes are, how it was aged, you know, the time that it was aged. Are there things in tech sheets that you find necessary and important, or are they just largely back-end information that you sort of use to confirm things that you might be already tasting?
You know, I think I have a love-hate relationship with tech sheets.
Same.
I can't tell you how many times I'm like, I'm going to call this winery and offer to rewrite their tech sheet.
I'm sure they take you up on it.
I'm such a nudge about, like, come on, this isn't even logically written, or do not tell me that this goes with pasta and chicken. I'm going to throw myself off the roof of the building if you tell me that, right? But yeah, I mean, tech sheets, if you know a lot already, then tech sheets can help. But they can also kind of steer you wrong because, you know, let's say you read that this wine is 72% of the wine was in oak, 68% of that oak was new French oak. What are you to deduce? I mean, you have to know a whole lot about oak and then it came from the cooper known, the forest known as Troncay in central France. You have to know a lot before that really helps you to know something about the wine.
Right.
So tech sheets can also be a little off-putting, and they can make you feel worse because you're like, oh, okay, I don't know what the Troncay forest, like, is that supposed to have a flavor? I don't know. Although something you said earlier, Amanda, really struck me, which is about liking a wine or not. Because wine is very idiosyncratic in this way. So is food. There are foods and there are wines that I call rite of passage foods. Like the first time you tasted a raw bivalve, a lot of people, or the first bite of sushi ever, you might have said, ooh, I don't know, uni, I don't think I can have this, right? It's a little, you think to yourself, I don't think I like this. But by the 25th time, you're like the person who can't wait to order uni in the Japanese restaurant or can't wait to order 24 raw oysters. So when people say they don't like a wine, when I have students, and my students are usually adults, right? They say, oh, I don't like this wine. I say, okay, there are two possibilities. You don't like it ever, or you haven't drunk enough of it yet, because you may not have had enough of it to actually form a good opinion. You kind of have to hit the baseball 25 times before you get a feel for it. So maybe you started out thinking, I hate Argentine Malbec. But at some point along the line, you know, someone, you just had to go over to someone's house and all they had was Argentine Malbec. And all of a sudden, the light switch flipped and you realize, oh, ooh, I kind of do like this. So when you don't like wine, I think you also have to still remain open-minded about it. Because lots of us didn't like something in the beginning that after we've had it a number of times, things like sherry, you realize, oh, I'm in love with it now.
That makes me think of two things. And it's such a fair and valid point. One of those things is, okay, maybe you didn't like it, but did it make you think? Was it something that you've never tasted before and did it make you think? And if it did, then there's a high probability that you should be revisiting that wine a lot, because eventually you're going to get to the one that you like. And you're not only going to think about it, you're actually going to be falling head over heels in love with it, because now you have this dual-ended relationship. And the other part of that is Andrew Zimmern years ago had this great quote when he was still doing like Bizarre Foods, and he was talking about a particular cuisine somewhere in Asia, and someone said, "Oh my gosh, you're going to eat that." And he said, "A billion people can't be wrong."
Yeah, exactly.
And it stuck with me. And I think to your point of Argentine Malbec, right? Maybe it's not for you. Maybe this particular one isn't for you. Maybe most of them aren't for you. But there's a hell of a lot of Argentine Malbec out there, and it's very popular. And I would argue that the same sort of adage can kind of be translated into this pathway as well, because there's a lot of it out there, and there's probably something that you're going to like. And I don't think everyone universally can be wrong about this. I felt that way about Sauvignon Blanc for years. I was not a fan of the grape, and it really wasn't until I started tasting Sauvignon Blanc from like Dan Petrosky's Massacan, a beautiful example of Sauvignon Blanc, that I really started to appreciate the grape and see it for what it was. And it took me a little while. Now, do I gravitate towards it all the time? Absolutely not. But there are fantastic examples of it. And, you know, through life, we find little entry points into wines. And when you do find them, they're so special because you'll remember them that much more fondly. And when I think back over the course of my career, it's often the wines that I started off not liking and then eventually grew to love that I have the best and most solidified memories about. Champagne is one of them as well, interestingly.
So right. I completely agree with you. Yes. I mean, I remember the very first time I mentioned sherry, the very first time I went to Jerez in southern Spain, which is the region that produces sherry, I came back and I thought, okay, I'm writing an article called Death by Sherry. I could not get it.
There's only so much ham and sherry one can have, right?
Yes. But sure enough, after more repeated experiences, it became one of my most favorite wines. And, you know, wine, just like food, can be a rite of passage. You have to sometimes just stay with it for a while.
You know, as you're continuing your journey at home, obviously keep an open mind, but also be mindful of where you're sourcing your wines, because just as there are some fantastic bottles out there, there are also some stinkers. And if you're not sourcing them at the right places, meaning maybe don't buy them at your gas station, right? Like,
yes.
If you wouldn't buy like a quality piece of like fruit there, then it's probably not the place for you. Just always keep that in mind. You know, a store can tell you a lot about what is inside of it, and you should be paying attention to your surroundings. And I think there's a few red flags and green flags when you walk into a wine shop. Are there red flags and green flags for you?
Well, if it's 102 degrees in there, I'm pretty worried. Which can be an issue with the big box stores.
Yeah.
I mean, those stores are usually highly conscious of temperature because they now, all the big box stores sell food too. But it's hard to air condition a store that is a giant warehouse store. So that's the first thing I notice is, how does it feel in here? Does it feel kind of cool, or, which is good, or does it feel kind of hot in here? And then I think, you know, I want to get a feel for how much do I think the people in this store know. One of the unintended but kind of devastating effects of the rise of critics in the U.S. is that retail stores realized, oh, we don't even have to hire people anymore who know anything about wine. We can just hire kind of stock guys to just load, you know, wine onto shelves, because we can excerpt critics' write-ups, print them on little cards, and tape them to the shelf, you know, so-called shelf talkers.
That's right.
And so a whole generation of men and women who really did know about wine no longer worked in retail stores. Retail stores were just full of stock people. So there's nothing like, I think, finding a good place where you can, you really feel like there's someone there who you can talk to, who can turn you on to things that they know that you otherwise maybe wouldn't choose. So I always look for, like, is there someone here who's really a wine person, who really knows a lot? That gives me a confidence about the store in general.
I feel that way about buying cheese as well.
Yes. Yes.
A good cheesemonger is like, it's like a kindred spirit. When you find it, like you latch on, and that's where you go forever and always. And you find it hard to go and buy cheese anywhere else. Maybe that's just me because I love cheese, but I do think it's true. And I think it translates in multiple aspects of life, whether you're shopping for clothes or cheese or wine. You know, a trust agent in the wine world or a kindred spirit, someone that you feel like you can have a conversation with, is so critical. And of course, you know, this is the Wine Access Unfiltered podcast. And so we're talking about an online retail front. And there are people that you can talk to at Wine Access, believe it or not. You can call them up and have a conversation with them, and they'll direct you in that way.
I also like to ask other people in the store why they are buying the wine they're buying. I mean, and this can yes. be, you know, it can, I would just actually stop a person and say, oh, that's such an interesting wine you have in your cart there. Tell me about it. Like, why are you buying that? And, you know, I mean, most people actually will tell you. They'll be like, either, I don't know, my friend told me about it and I'm giving it a try, or I love this wine because it's really crisp, or whatever they say. But I absolutely love to talk to other people in the aisles. And of course, I mean, you and I live in St. Helena, the little town in Napa Valley, with our little local store called Sunshine, and aisle five mm-hmm. with all the wine. I mean, this is great to do if you ever visit St. Helena, because in the aisle are going to be all these famous winemakers. You may even not even know that they are famous winemakers, but they're buying
yep.
all kinds of fun stuff. You can get turned on to lots of good wines that way.
Great tip. Sunshine is the best. And yes, yeah. aisle five is loaded with not only the best selection of wine for a grocery store in the history of grocery stores, but also the people who made them are probably like around yes. the corner from you shopping for broccoli. It's a wild experience that can really only happen in Napa Valley. So if you're there, I highly recommend. They also have like a great selection of cheeses and meats
yes.
and fun snacks. If you are going to be picnicking in the area, yes. it's a good stop.
I remember Margaret Mondavi, who passed away a few years ago, sadly, but Margaret was maybe 5'2", and she would say, Karen, dear, reach me that, choose some wine on the top shelf, which were usually the most expensive wines. Reach me that Alsace Kürstraminer up there. Everybody and anybody in the Napa Valley is in this little grocery store of ours.
Karen, this has been so much fun. Of course, you added all of the value add and super helpful tips, but I know people can continue learning from you via your newsletter, Wine Speed, which just, I'm so glad, moved to as sort of subscription model, right?
Yes, we did that last fall. And, you know, our subscribers, I have to say, if you are one of our subscribers, thank you. Our subscribers are so fun. We have an 80% open rate.
Wow.
They are people who just love wine. But part of it is that Wine Speed, I know you know it, Amanda. I mean, mm-hmm. it's fun. It's fast. There's always fascinating information in it. We always do a wine quiz every week. I mean, it's really a fast and easy way to learn about wine. Yeah. So join us, winespeed.com.
Yeah. It's incredible the amount of content that you can put out in a week. It should be paid. It should be under that kind of umbrella, because it is a wealth of information, and you're always adding fantastic insight and opinions that get us all talking, which is great. The Wine Bible is now in its third iteration. It is a perennial favorite of mine. It is a consistent, please get this for anyone who is thinking about learning about wine or getting into the wine industry. It's a must-have. It's, you know, if you are even considering drinking a glass of wine, you should have the Wine Bible next to you. And I know that's a big accomplishment for you to get a third iteration of that out.
It has a life of its own, man. Writing that book is just, you know, the first one took 10 unpaid years. The second one, though, was 5.5 years. And this third edition only took 4 years. So I'm getting so fast. Man, I'm knocking this out now.
It's all that wine speed.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Speeding along.
Speeding along. So Wine Speed, the Wine Bible, it looks like you've got your own line of glassware as well, so you can drink along with Karen. Where else can people find you that they should know? Anywhere else I missed?
Yeah, either KarenMcNeil.com or winespeed.com. And we're on all the usual social media channels at Karen McNeil Co., just C-O. Yeah, so we do quite a bit on especially Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You can join us on Substack as well. We have a free newsletter on Substack.
Well, with all that, it's incredible that you had the hour and change to spare for us today. But I'm, like I said, incredibly grateful. And it's always wonderful to spend time with you and share a glass. And I look forward to seeing what other opinions you have ahead, because it seems like Instagram is the place to be when it comes to having a great conversation in the comments and offering perspective and asking questions. If we impart one thing to you today, it's ask the questions, make sure that they're of pure mind and with the intention that you want a real answer. But please keep asking questions and please keep listening and following us here. This is going to be available on YouTube as well as wherever you're listening to podcasts. So make sure wherever that is, you're subscribed. If you are loving this show, we love for you to leave us a review. And of course, if you're not a member of the Wine Club, this is your chance to get in on it in time for season 3. I look forward to seeing more of you guys on here. Thank you so much for being with us these 3 seasons. It's been my pleasure this afternoon, and cheers to y'all. See you soon.
Thanks, Amanda.